It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh, and there's Chuck, and Jerry's hanging out, and this is Stuff You Should Know, our continuing architecture slash design suite.
Which we love.
Surprisingly interesting stuff, huh?
Yeah, and this one, I mean, listen however you listen, but if you have a choice, I really would urge you to listen to this when you can look at pictures of things. This one above many, many episodes requires you to look at this stuff as you're listening, ideally.
Yeah.
And so if you can do that, do that.
Yeah, because we're going to be mentioning specific buildings that you could go check out and be like, oh, this is what they're talking about. We're going to do our best, but we're going to be describing structures, and it's just way easier to look at the structure, you know?
It's got a swoopy, pointy thing.
Yeah, and that's basically it.
Livia was kind enough to insert hyperlinks into what she sent us, and that made it super easy. I didn't even have to Google the Googie.
And that is what we're talking about. It's not a typo, everybody. It's Googie. It's a kind of architecture, G-O-O-G-I-E. And it is basically the architecture that you think of when you think of the 1950s, mid-50s to the very early 60s in America.
Well, the 50s when they were thinking of the 90s.
Exactly. That's a really good way to
put it. Or what that might look like.
Yeah, and they were way, way off. But I mean, how great would the 90s have been if it looked like what they thought it was going to look like in the 50s? I think it would have been pretty cool. Because I am personally a really big fan of Googie architecture. It's nothing like, I don't go tour the buildings or anything like that. In fact, there's one in Georgia, and I looked up where that town is, and I'm like, no, it's not worth the drive. But I do like looking at pictures of them.
I might. That bank is 3.5 hours from my house, and I want to open up an account there just so I can drive down to that amazing building in the middle of nowhere, southeast Georgia.
It is really the middle. It's not near anything, nothing, nowhere around it, but it does have a really fine example of Googie architecture, which we'll get to, which we should probably define beyond. It's the architecture that you think of when you think of the 50s or 60s.
Right. And before we define it, I just want to say that my love affair with Googie started out when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah.
When I first went to Tomorrowland at Disney World.
Oh, yeah.
And then when I started watching the Jetsons. Mm-hmm. And being in Georgia, I didn't see any examples of Googie really growing up, but took my first trip to LA in 1988. Mm-hmm. Saw a bunch of Googie. I was like, I love this stuff. And then in the 1994, I took my first trip to New York where I met my friend Bob. And this was not exterior architecture, but this was that early to mid-90s sort of design, like kind of space age bachelor pad design movement.
That's called Populux, I saw.
Yeah, and that's sort of akin to Googie. And Bob had his stuff like that, and I thought it was so cool, and he told me about Googie, and that's the first time I had heard that word was in 1994.
That's hilarious. I heard the word the first time, like, this month, I think.
Well, oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Never heard it before. You don't hear it a lot, but I think people that know it like to tell other people and name it.
Right.
And Bob was one of those people, because I remember when Google came along when I was living in LA, and I was like the architecture? And everyone went, huh? So anyway, that's just a long personal preamble. Should we define it?
I like it. Yeah, let's define it, Chuck. Have at it.
All right. So this was this came about post-World War II. Mm-hmm. And I love how Livia put this. It was influenced by the techno-optimism of that era.
Yeah.
Which was a thing. It was like, hey, it was like Tomorrowland. This is what the future is going to be like. And, you know, it's going to have like cool shapes and things are going to look like rocket ships and cars can have these big fins and look like spaceships. Mm-hmm. And we love neon lights and we love these gentle pastels. And it was kind of a populist movement.
Yeah.
In that it wasn't like just meant for the rich.
No, it wasn't meant for the rich. And as a matter of fact, one of the other big definitions of it is that it was a commercial movement. So like you didn't really see anybody's house constructed in Googie, but you would see like a dry cleaner or a bowling alley or a coffee shop. That was a big one.
Yeah,
or a diner.
Sure.
So these were places that like any American could go to and did. So it was really fun, eye-popping, bright-colored space age design and architecture for the everyday person. And that's definitely one of the things that made it so lovable, but it's also conversely one of the things that made like architecture critics and like, you know, legitimate, I'm making scare quotes, architects hate it because it was populist in nature.
Yeah, for sure. It emerged and largely stayed in California. It did, you know, we'll talk about where it did branch out mm-hmm. here and there across the U.S., but it's really a California thing and really a Southern California thing. And California at the time really did sort of represent the future in a lot of ways post-World War II. It was, you know, it was the Far West, and it was, I think, a city where people moved to from the East that saw possibilities in California, the land of sunshine, the land of the future. And the whole idea of this commercial part of it was let's design, let's say, a gas station that will really stand out it was a car culture, you know, after World War II, and let's design something that can really be noticed when you're speeding down the highway.
Yeah, that was a really big driving force for Googie. Like if you look at a Googie building, you see it like a mile away or many miles away because of the bright colors, because of the weird angles. It really mm-hmm. is designed to stand out from its surroundings. A lot of architecture is designed to complement, blend, kind of be seamless with its surroundings, whether that's yeah. nature or existing buildings. Googie did not take that into account at all and actually went the opposite way. And one of the big reasons was because in California, it is a car culture, to get people's attention as they're speeding past, you kind of have to use those design elements. And that was basically why Googie came along.
That's right. I mentioned the Jetsons, and that wasn't just in jest. That was a real thing. It was inspired by things like the Jetsons. If you look at the original Hanna-Barbera studio building in on Cahuenga in West Hollywood, it was a Googie building. It was sort of Googie meets Art Deco, which Googie has a little bit of its roots in Art Deco in mm-hmm. some ways. And also, you know, I guess we should talk about some other kinds of architecture that it sort of sprang from. Art Deco is one, and then one that is also super cool is called Streamline Moderne. Mm-hmm. And that is, if you look up any Streamline Moderne building, you might think you're looking at an ocean liner or something. There are no squared corners on these buildings. Like everything, which is also very Art Deco, has these beautiful rounded edges.
Yeah, which is really neat. There's also usually structures that kind of suggest like a ocean liner's smokestacks or something. Sometimes they even put portholes in the buildings. Like there was a Coca-Cola bottling plant that was Streamline Moderne in the 30s, I think, maybe 40s in LA. And it has straight up portholes on it. Like it's meant to look like a ship. And so this idea that you could make something look like something else, but also look very elegant, definitely kind of formed part of the foundation for Googie architecture.
It's very cool. Another thing that influenced it is called programmatic or mimetic architecture. This is basically like how you would see it today is if you like see the Hard Rock Hotel in Florida, that it looks like a giant guitar. It is something that is very intentionally, sort of like a gimmick, designed to look like something else and not just like, oh, that evokes an airplane. It's no, it looks like an airplane or right. a giant hot dog or something.
Yeah, very frequently, especially with Mimetic, the structure was the thing that it was selling. So like you might have an orange juice stand and like the building was a giant orange.
It's kind of tacky, but it's fun.
Oh, it's awesome. I saw pictures of an abandoned one in Florida somewhere. I don't know where it is, but it would be cool to go see. And then like the Brown Derby, the very famous Brown Derby restaurant in LA. It's a Brown Derby, a brown hat.
Brown Derby.
Or like those donut shops that are like a giant donut.
Yeah.
That is all mimetic architecture. And one of the reasons that that gave rise to Googie is because that's what's called a vulgar vernacular. It's the kind of thing that you don't even need an architect to do. Like the owner of the donut shop could say, hey, construction guys, I want this to be a donut. Build it for me out of whatever you want to build it out of. And you didn't need an architect at all. And that was a big thing that kind of, it was also populist in that respect as well.
Yeah, and Googie, that was a way scaled back version of that, though. You know?
Definitely, yeah.
I mean, it would evoke like a rocket ship, but if it was a straight up rocket ship, then that I think it became mimetic.
Right, yeah. That, it definitely transgressed and crossed that line for sure.
One of the first Googie buildings is from 1949, which would have put it really on the leading edge of that whole movement. And it's still there. It's a great place. Like, LA is a really great place to drive around and see some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. It made me miss living there a lot because I would go to some of these places and see some of these places on a daily basis. But Bob's Big Boy in Burbank in 1949, designed by Wayne McAllister, who will pop up a couple of times in this episode. And he built the El Rancho in Las Vegas and Bob's Big Boy in Burbank, which is, it's really known for its 35-foot high sign of depicting Bob himself.
Right. Is that who it's supposed to be in the red and white checkered overalls?
Yeah, there's some connection to Shoney's, and I never really looked it up, but it's like Shoney's Big Boy. That may have just been the franchise name or something.
I think so, because in Ohio, it was Frisch's Big Boy, and they all used the same Big Boy. Yeah.
And it was you.
It was me. That's who I aspired to be as a child.
Get out your overalls. So Bob's Big Boy is a landmark, literally. In 1992, the California Office of Historic Preservation declared it an official historic landmark because they wanted to, of course, tear it down, which sadly happened to so many great Googie and other buildings.
Yeah, but not Bob's Big Boy in Burbank, which is a lot of bees. And the reason why it's considered the first Googie building is, one, it was from 1949, but it follows so much of the Googie aesthetic. Like you said, a 35-foot sign. As attention-grabbing as possible, with flashing lights, neon lights, with giant letters. Usually the building is one story. I believe with Bob's Big Boy, the roof kind of swoops in different directions, or it'll go up and then down, like in a zigzag. It just, the roofs do weird things in a Googie structure. And there's a bunch of other things, too, like sweeping arches or parabolas. Like the original McDonald's had two parabolas on either side. That was the original Golden Arches,
I think,
in Downey, California. Yeah, that was very Googie inspired, although I think it was even earlier than some of these other buildings.
I think, we'll get to that one. I think it was the 50s, right?
All right, sure, yeah. Like I said, roofs can be cantilevered, upswept. They can look like curved themselves. They're usually outlined in lights, flashing lights, neon lights. Sometimes it looks kind of spacey, like you said, not exactly a rocket ship, but suggested of it. Geometric shapes that suggest motion, like boomerang shapes and starbursts. Yeah. That's huge too. The fonts that they use are really exaggerated and big and attention grabbing. And again, the signage, really, really high, really, really gaudy, like sometimes many, many times taller than the building structure itself.
Yeah, so many of the Googie roof lines really do seem to defy gravity. And that was kind of one of the points, I think, was to make people wonder how they built it. And there are buildings in LA, we're going to talk about that gas station in Beverly Hills, that for back then, you know, now they have such lighter and stronger materials. But, you know, you're talking about building these things, a lot of concrete in the 1950s. And some of these roofs that just, swoop up and extend to this tiny point, you know, 50 feet above the ground. Mm-hmm. And you're just wondering, how in the world did they accomplish this back then?
Yeah. And that was pretty the cool point. They just say, it's googie.
That's right. Should we take a break?
Yeah, let's take a break.
All right. We'll be right back with more googie.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us. Oh, yeah.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
So what's Googie anyway? Where'd they get that name?
Oh, actually, it's named after a specific cafe that was built the same year as Bob's Big Boy. It's also sometimes considered the first Googie structure. And the reason why is because the cafe was named Googie's. The owner, Mortimer Burton, named it after his wife, whose family nickname was Googie. And it wasn't like he said, hey, create a whole new architecture, John Lautner, and we're going to name it after my wife. He had no say in that. It was just that this Googie's coffee shop was a really good early example of this new kind of architecture that was starting to spread in Southern California.
Yeah, and John Lautner is one of my favorite architects of all time.
Yeah, he's neat.
He was a protege of Frank Lloyd Wright. He did most of his work in the Southland there in Southern California. And because the weather is so great there and the sun is always shining and all the things that people hate about LA that don't live in LA, you can really do big inside out floor plans where the outside is brought in and you can have huge pieces of glass and exposed wood, and it just, everything weathers so much better out there. So you're really freed up as an architect to do things when you don't have to worry about torrential downpours of rain for many, many days of the year and things like that.
Right.
And he has built some of the great houses in LA, some of the great modern homes. One which I actually is one of my least favorite of his, but maybe the most well known, is the Chemosphere House. It's a little too much for me, but yeah? I get it. It looks like a spaceship.
It's pretty famous. It's like, it's almost like if the eyepiece that LeVar Burton wore in Star Trek: The Next Generation was turned into a house and then thrust into the side of a hill on a cliff. Yeah. That would be the Chemosphere House.
My favorite was made very famous. It's a famous house on its own if you're into architecture, but was made famous in The Big Lebowski, which is the Sheets Goldstein house, which was Jackie Treehorn's house.
Oh, so when I started looking at, I think I just said Chemosphere, and that's way different. The Chemosphere House pictures, I was wondering if it was that house, and I was like, I don't quite think it is, but it's not surprising to me that that was from the same architect.
Yeah, it's a Lautner house. So just if you have time and you're into architecture, just go check out a bunch of Lautner homes. They're amazing.
So he is a really great architect. And like you said, he was a protege of Frank Lloyd Wright. That in and of itself automatically made him a serious architect in the architecture world. But he was kind of into Googie as well. He designed that first Googie's Cafe or Googie's Coffee Shop in the Googie style. And so it was a criticism of that work of Lautner, Googie's Coffee Shop, that a guy named Douglas Haskell, who was an architecture critic, wrote an article in 1952, just like really drippingly satirical article. Kind of one of those things where you just talk about how great something is, but you're discrediting the narrator. Yeah. So anything they're saying, like all this praise is actually, veiled criticism or poorly veiled criticism. And he was the one who coined the term Googie to describe the architecture, naming it after that restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it might as well just say every 10th word in parentheses, eye roll.
Right, exactly.
Because he did the very cowardly thing, which is made a fictional character up to explain what Googie, this fictional character in this article was Professor Thrug, and it was just dripping with cynicism. That he was talking about, or rather, excuse me, Thrug, the character, was talking about let me just read this bit. It was saying that Googie should look both organic and be abstract, featuring abstract mushrooms or a geometric bird, or even better, an abstract mushroom surmounted by an abstract bird.
It's kind of hilarious. But one thing he does say is, he says that it's the roof of Googie's starts off, or Googie's itself starts on the level like any other building, but suddenly it breaks for the sky. And he wasn't kidding. Like if you look up Googie's, the 1949 Googie's Coffee Shop, on one side of it, the entire building, not just the roof, but the entire building goes up at an angle, like it's on a hinge, and that whole side of the building is angled, like it's gone up. It's nuts. It's the only way you can say it. And so he's critical of that. But that really weird gravity-defying roof and, in fact, gravity-defying building, that became like a trademark part of Googie. And what's funny is Lautner was considered serious enough that on the next page after Douglas Haskell's scathing criticism in that 1952 article of House and Home is a profile of Lautner and his work because he's a serious architect and everybody knew it.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the trick of this thing is I'm sure the tongue was in cheek and maybe Haskell was just trying to have a little bit of fun and I'm taking it too seriously.
Right. Well, it was an obnoxious thing to do for sure.
It was pretty obnoxious. But the takeaway is that they wrote about it and they could have continued to ignore it. Mm-hmm. But they even said that though House and Home's editors would prefer to not go nearly so far, as Lautner does. They believe that serious designer Lautner should no longer be officially ignored. So, you know, we'll recognize you by making fun of it.
It's like House and Home were like the head of a high school clique or something.
Right, exactly.
So Lautner's very much associated with Googie, but he was not the only one. And what also makes Googie so populist is that it was decentralized. There were a bunch of different people working in Southern California trying to do the same aim, which was get as many eyeballs onto their customer's building to bring that many more people into the customer's business. Because again, it's a commercial architecture movement and it was totally decentralized and anybody could push whatever envelope they wanted to. Anything really went.
Yeah, the Googie, almost said Googie Hauser. The Googie House movement was much more limited. It's kind of cool, but it doesn't fit houses as much as it fits like a bowling alley.
Yeah, or even like a dry cleaner, like anything. You could just be like, give me one of those buildings.
Yeah. So there was an architectural firm that was hugely responsible for building a lot of these buildings or designing a lot of them. And it was Armette and Davis, opened in 1947 by Eldon Davis and I guess Louis Armette. And they basically saw a big opportunity in the commercial sector. I think they were industrial designers initially, and they started getting hired to build these buildings. And kind of one of the really cool parts of their story is they hired a junior draftsperson named Helen Liu Fong. And this was someone who graduated with a degree in city planning from Berkeley in 1949, but could only get work as a secretary because she was an Asian woman. Mm-hmm. And Armette and Davis gave Helen Fong a chance as a junior draftsperson, and she ended up being kind of one of the sort of central influencers, and I use that in the old school use of the term,
right?
Of that movement.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool that they did that too. So one of the first things they unleashed on was the Clock Restaurant in Westchester, which is, there's not that many images of it. If you can find it, it's pretty cool. Like I saw an original sketch that I guess Helen Fong must have done. And it's just all sorts of angles and one triangle jutting out of another triangle. And it's just a really neat building. Like I can only imagine being like a junior architect and them saying like, go nuts, like do whatever you want. And they're going to love it. So that was her first one. Her next one and the most famous one was Pan's Coffee Shop on La Tierra. Am I saying that right?
La Tierra.
La Tierra. Oh, I got all fancy. in L.A., obviously.
Yeah, and that's probably not the technical way to pronounce it, but that's how everyone says it, I think.
No, I get it. I'm a descriptionist.
It was built in 1958. It has, again, one of those dramatically angled roofs, uses a lot of neon, and flagstone was a big deal with coffee shops. There were a lot of flagstone walls at coffee shops back then, big plate glass windows in a lot of these coffee shops. And they described it as a place where George Jetson and Fred Flintstone could meet over a cup of coffee.
Yeah, because you're using flagstone amidst like formica and like boomerang and space imagery. That was a quote from a guy named Alan Hess, who's an architecture historian, who literally wrote the book not once but twice on Googie and actually kicked off a Googie preservation movement in the late 80s, actually, as we'll see.
Hooray for Hess, right?
That's right. Up with Hess.
We talked a lot about coffee shops. It was actually kind of also called Coffee Shop Modern because there were so many of them. Armette and Davis and Fong built, or I'm sorry, designed more than 4,000 of these coffee shops.
Right.
That's crazy. That's like all the coffee shops.
What's funny is if you, there was an obit of Davis, I can't remember when he died, but he died a very old man. And he had said that he didn't really see much of a reason to preserve these buildings, which I think is a little modest.
Yeah.
Because people are saying, like, these are masterpieces. Like, they it's just that the architecture world didn't appreciate them, but they're great buildings, and people are destroying them. And the reason why is because, as Davis pointed out, these are commercial buildings. And I saw someone describe commercial buildings as probably the architecture that's under the most pressure to reinvent and mm-hmm. reshape itself to
yeah.
keep up with the times. Like, you can't be sentimental with your
right.
commercial building. If Googie is out, and it went out fairly quick, you got to scrap it and start over and update, or else people are going to think your business is behind and behind the times and out of touch. And you just can't let that happen, or else you're going to lose out on business. So he was saying, like, they were commercial buildings. Like, what do you want? Of course, people are going to tear them down and replace them with something else.
Yeah, I never really thought about that. That's interesting, because unless you do something really revolutionary and you have a, you know, Netflix show about your house,
mm-hmm.
You can go out in 2022 and say, I want to build a colonial, and no one will be like, really? I mean, it may not be your particular style, but they still build colonial houses and craftsmen's and all kinds of houses from all sorts of eras. But I think a commercial building, that really makes a lot of sense. Like, you can't go out and build a commercial building that looks 30 years old.
Right.
You might can go out and build something that looks like 50 years old if it's some kind of cool retro thing.
Right.
But you can't be anywhere in between and build something that looks dated, you know?
No, you can't. It can be classic, but it can't be dated. I think
yeah.
that's the fatal flaw, is dated.
Totally.
And Googie dated itself very quickly, as we'll see.
That's right.
And then there was Norms, too. We
yeah.
got to mention Norms. That was another Helen Fong classic, too, which is just like a great example of Googie architecture.
I think Norms is still there, too.
Yes. I believe it was also designated a historic and cultural monument by the LA City Council, because it was going to go under the wrecking ball. And they stepped in and said, nope, you're not going to tear down this norm. So it is still there. And it is an awesome building.
It's great. It's on La Cienega, right there in Hollywood, like a lot of these buildings are. The Holiday Bowl, this was a really special story. There's a bowling alley on Crenshaw Boulevard in Crenshaw in Los Angeles. And Fong designed the interior, and there was a bar in there called Sabika.
Sakiba. I'll bet it was so awesome.
I bet it was hopping, man. The cool thing about this area at the time was it was one of the only integrated parts of Los Angeles. The local high school literally had one-third African-American, one-third Asian-American, and one-third white kids.
Really?
Yeah, and that was what made the Holiday Bowl so special, is you had these different cultures and groups of people getting together where they didn't do so in most parts of Los Angeles at the time.
That's cool.
And they had that, not only were they bowling, but there was a coffee shop on the premises. And when we keep saying coffee shop, these were coffee shop like the Pulp Fiction. They were like diners, basically.
Yeah, I saw that they were a step up from diners, but not, you know, as nice as like a regular restaurant.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's what I saw him describe.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. But at the Holiday Bowl diner, I'm sorry, the Holiday Bowl coffee shop,
mm-hmm.
They had all kinds of food. They had udon. They had grits and southern, like, soul food. They had straight-up burgers and fries. I read an article where people were saying, like, this was, you know, the first time they ever had sushi in their life, and this was in the 1950s and early 60s,
wow. Yeah.
Which was crazy. Or I don't know if they had sushi that early, but at least at some point they did.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 24/7 place where people could go hang out. They could drink at the bowling alley, go to this coffee shop after. And it was actually protected during the LA riots in 92. Like, residents of Crenshaw lined up outside of the Holiday Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
So people wouldn't touch it.
So I saw that it was demolished, but I also saw a picture from 3 years after it was supposedly demolished, and it was still there. But the coffee shop is now a Starbucks, and the bowling alley is now a Walgreens, it looks like.
Yeah, so what they did was they did destroy the actual bowling alley part
mm-hmm.
and rebuilt it as a Walgreens. But that
okay.
exterior coffee shop facade is still attached, and it is a Starbucks.
Yeah, but it's still Googie.
Yeah, it looks cool.
So there are some other ones. We mentioned the original or one of the earliest McDonald's from Downey, California, 1953.
It's the oldest building. One's still there, I think.
Right. Low building, parabolas on either side.
Yeah, and that McDonald's, like you mentioned, is in Downey. And we talked about it in the McDonald's Taco episode.
Bell. Taco Bell one, too, I think.
Oh, really? Okay. I thought you were making a joke.
No, for real. The taco episode, because we talked about Taco Bell, and like there are a bunch of ones from Downey, California.
Oh, okay. But it's an amazing looking restaurant, and it's got a really cool little museum, McDonald's Museum, next door. So you can still walk up. It's just a sort of counter service, but you can't go in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What do you call those? A walk-through?
Takeout.
A walk-up, takeout?
Sure, any of those.
I think someone said they built finally built a drive-through, but I don't think you can dine in still.
Boy, I guess they're the first McDonald's to have a drive-through then.
No, I think more recently built a drive-through.
No, I'm just teasing.
Okay.
One of the other things you mentioned, the Holiday Bowl, and bowling alleys were just like begging to be made into googie structures. And another good example is the Covina Bowl in Covina, California, which I guess is around Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And it still remains. It's still there. It's up for grabs exactly what's going to happen to it. But they're in talks to somehow preserve some of the facade or structure or sign or something as they redevelop it, I think, into condos. But it was designed by a firm that created 50 bowling alleys throughout California in the 7 years between 1955 and 62. And, I mean, I think actually this is what gave me the idea for this episode, Chuck, because I was looking at old bowling alleys.
Oh, in the bowling episode?
Yeah, and I came across the term googie. Because I was like, this is just such a cool looking bowling alley. And sure enough, it was googie, and it just led to one thing led to another. And here we are.
Well, that Hollywood Star Lanes where the Big Lebowski was shot was very googie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just I meant to mention during the Lautner segment, I saw that they just a few years ago, one of the Lautner homes was up for sale, which is a rarity in and of itself. But it was, and I say, only $2.5 million. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money for a house, to be sure. But I just thought with L.A., Southern California real estate anyway, and it's this historic building and an historic architect, and it's amazing, I thought it would be like $12 million.
Yeah, you definitely think that. So, yeah, it was a steal.
I was very
then.
Surprised. I mean, it seemed like a steal. I didn't have the cash on me, but it looked pretty amazing. And we should mention the Ships coffee shops as well, right? Those the little tiny three coffee shop chain.
Yeah, they were kind of boomerang shaped from what I could tell. I couldn't see like a really good picture of those guys. But I thought what was kind of cute is apparently every location had a toaster on every table.
Best idea of all time, except for the liability, probably.
The liability, but also like every once in a while, there's a crank that would come in and be like, well, I want a discount since I have to toast it myself.
Man.
And because I can think of that, that means that there's a possibility I might have been that guy.
I want to make my own toast in restaurants more than anything.
It does seem like a good idea for sure.
It's a very specific thing how people like their toast made. So I love that idea, but hats off to Ships for that.
One other one, too, that's kind of an icon of Googie. You mentioned before that Gulf 76 station.
Mm, amazing.
That's in Beverly Hills. And it apparently, the design of it, not the Gulf station itself, but the design of this roof, it's been likened to a flying carpet. And it really kind of looks like one. It's got some of the most amazing curves I've ever seen that just don't make any sense whatsoever. For a roof, but it really looks cool. And once you understand that it was supposed to be part of the LAX airport,
yeah,
then you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But apparently it got cut out of the design, but the designer, Jin Wong, was like, this is too cool to just not do. Let's just turn it into a gas station instead.
I've gotten gas there. I wasn't in Beverly Hills much, but mm-hmm. I tried to get gas there when I could. It's at Crescent Drive mm-hmm. and Little Santa Monica Boulevard in Beverly Hills, and it is a very, very cool gas station.
Okay.
I shot at one of these out in the desert, which I guess leads
Were
us to a break.
Were you arrested?
No. We shot a TV commercial at one of these roadside gas stations, like a Route 66 type of deal, out in the middle of nowhere that, looking back, was super googie. And that leads us to a break, because we're going to come back and talk about the desert and Las Vegas.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of 7 questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same 7 questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. 7 questions, limitless answers.
Okay, Chuck, you set us up maybe better than we've ever been set up before. And if you've been sitting here listening to us describe Googie architecture, or even going and looking at some of the photos, you might be like, man, this seems really Vegas to me. You would be right about that, because it got exported to Vegas pretty quick and took off like a rocket there, starting with the Sands in 1952. It was the first Googie-esque structure there, because before that, it was all like bolero ties and wagon wheels.
I know, isn't and that
then,
funny?
Yeah. And then the Sands came along and said, you hicks, we're going to start something new. We're the mafia. We're the trend-settingest mafia of all time.
We're going to take you into the space age. and that Sands was, I think you said, built in 52. And that brings back Mr. Wayne McAllister into the picture, who designed that Bob's Big Boy in Burbank just a few years before that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just look up any image of the old Sands casino sign, and it had that egg carton grid. It was really tall. It was like close to 60 feet in the air. Mm-hmm. Very geometric shapes, and the script was super Googie as well. And I think Vegas took notice and said, you know, I don't know who those mob guys are talking to, but they're on to something here. And Googie started popping up everywhere, including probably most famously in that iconic Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas sign.
Yeah, that is super Googie. I mean, like, if you're ever talking to somebody about a Googie design and they ask you what you're talking about, just say the design of the Welcome to Las Vegas sign. It hits basically every chord on that. Like big exaggerated fonts, different kinds of fonts. There's starbursts. There's geometric shapes. There's a whole bunch of different colors. It's Googie in its deepest soul.
It is. It's a great sign. While I was looking all this stuff up, I was like, wait, I feel like there were old Howard Johnson's motels that were kind of Googie.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
And I looked and I looked and I couldn't find any. And then finally I did. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, a handful of those Hojos from that era had these big, swoopy, pointy, triangular roofs that went all the way down to the ground, kind of like an A-frame. Mm-hmm. and jutted way out over the roadway. And I knew I'd seen those in my past, but I don't think it was a lot of them, but it just kind of goes to show how Googie spread beyond California and Las Vegas.
Right.
And we're going to talk about a few more of those places.
Yeah, I mean, there's different, it just pops up in some random places. Like apparently the northwest side of Chicago was developed later than the rest of it. And it just so happened that Googie was having its heyday. So there's like some random Googie structures, Trim and Tidy Cleaners, Superdog, Pride Cleaners is really cool looking. I think that's the one that it looks like it's a giant triangle with the point sticking out streetward, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. It's really neat to see. And then the Ohio House Motel is what's called, it's like a subset of Googie architecture called phony colony, like faux colonial. Isn't that awesome?
I love that term.
Yeah.
Yeah, phony colony. it's going to be my newest insult.
Okay.
The Wildwoods Resort area of New Jersey has quite a few Googie kind of motels. They would mm-hmm. say, they would call it doo-wop style, because that's sort of the 1950s rock and roll scene there in the Jersey Shore at the time. But if you look up what the Morey family, M-O-R-E-Y, designed a number of those motels kind of near the Jersey Shore seaside.
Right.
And they're really cool looking. They're not quite as out there and spaceshippy, but they're definitely Googie. And then there's a newer one. I think, you know, now people are building the occasional kind of modern Googie throwback look. And the Starlux Hotel there is one pretty great example of that.
Yeah, I found a really great website called Modernist Architecture. And they have a post from 2015 called Wildwood, the East Coast capital of Googie, doo-wop. And it is a comprehensive photo spread of all these Googie structures in Wildwood on the Jersey Shore. And it just looks like an amazing place to wander around. But it's Googie through and through. I saw that, I think in that blog, they said that it's probably the densest concentration of Googie architecture left in the country.
Yeah, and it kind of fits the seaside sort of feel, mm-hmm. I think, with the pastels. And mm-hmm. it just sort of all works together, I think.
Yep. There's also some in Phoenix and Tucson. Probably most famous in Phoenix is what used to be called the 300 Bowl, a bowling alley again.
Yeah.
And I read that no one is exactly sure who designed it, what firm or what architect designed the 300 Bowl, but is a classic example of Googie architecture. There's also Paris Laundry and Dry Cleaning and the Rainbow Car Wash there. It's pretty cool stuff.
These episodes are fun because there's, I know there's people all over the country that love their little buildings to get shouted out in their towns.
Totally.
The Biff Burger drive-in chain in Clearwater. This was right in that sort of middle of that era in 1956. Lots of Googie-inspired stuff there. And then there's a shopping center, the Southgate Shopping Center in Lakeland, Florida, also mid to late 50s. Another great example.
Yeah, you got to look up the Biff Burger. Like look up Biff Burger 1956. And one of the big Googie things they have is like their sign is like different geometric structures, like separate from one another. And each one like holds a letter or a little message or something. They're all really brightly colored. It's just really cool and neat looking.
And we mentioned that great, those are great signs. I'm looking at them now. That great bank in the middle of nowhere, Georgia, in Alma, Georgia, the Alma Exchange Bank, 1966. You really need to look this one up and imagine this in sort of rural southeastern Georgia between Atlanta and Jacksonville. It is really something else. And there's a cool place right here, a newer place in Centennial Olympic Park in Atlanta called Googie Burger. And it's opened about 12 years ago in 2010. And it's a really cool modern take on a Googie style. And it's awesome. I didn't even know it was there.
And then also, Chuck, one of the other things, you know, we've been talking about things like dry cleaners and car washes and bowling alleys. Like it appeared in some like legit big structures like the theme building, the iconic building at LAX that looks like a War of the Worlds UFO basically on stilts. That is about as Googie as it gets that when it's not like a dry cleaners. That's a super Googie building.
Yeah, that one... people probably, you might have heard it called The Encounter because it had a restaurant and bar called The Encounter in it. But it is called the theme building. And it was there when I was there and open. And, you know, it was kind of a fun thing to go and like grab a cocktail before you pick someone up on an airport run and just kind of like drink in that vibe for a half hour or so. And then it closed in 2013 because there was always just a, it was right there by the airport. So usually it was airport people, but like you wouldn't go early enough if you were like flying somewhere just to go to a restaurant outside the airport. Cause it's not, you know, you can't check in and then go back out to the encounter.
Right.
And then going afterward, like maybe I think once I might've picked someone up that had just come into town who had never been to LA. It's like, hey, the first thing we'll do is go to the encounter. But it was just sort of had a problem of no one quite knew when to go. Because it was so tied to the airport. You didn't want to go there if you had nothing to do at the airport because you didn't want to be in the airport traffic, which is notoriously bad in LA. So it eventually kind of closed down because of this problem in 2013. It's pretty sad.
Yeah, it is a little sad, but it is super. It was a very inconvenient place for sure.
What about Tomorrowland that I mentioned seeing as a kid?
Tomorrowland, everybody, I don't want to say everybody, but almost everybody's been to either Tomorrowland at Disney World or Disneyland. And it's just like this retro future Googie architecture. It was at first. And I didn't know this, but apparently it was originally meant to mimic what they thought it was going to look like in 1986.
Yeah, isn't that funny?
What the people of 1955 thought 86 would look like.
Yeah, and I mentioned not too long ago, I took my first visit to Disney World since I was a kid recently, and I was shocked how little things had changed all throughout the park until I sort of stopped to think about it, because Disney people, like, they don't want anything different about that particular park. They're fine with, like, adding new things, but, like, you don't go in and change Tomorrowland and get rid of those cruddy race cars in favor of something better. You just leave, or the people mover, you leave it alone.
Yeah. And that's, I agree with that. I think that they should until it falls apart, until the people mover like falls off of the cable and kills a bunch of people.
Well, I think because Disney largely deals in the business of nostalgia.
Definitely. That's why John Hodgman hates that place.
What else do we have?
The TWA Flight Center at JFK.
Sure.
Eero Saarinen designed it, and it's amazing. So we don't need to say anything else about it, but it was built in 1962. Just go to the Curbed New York website and search for Explore the TWA Terminal. And it will, it's this is amazing photo spread from years back from a photographer named Max Tuohy, who was granted access to this abandoned but totally preserved 1962 GUI like terminal for TWA. It's the most amazing thing you'll ever see.
Googie?
It is a Googie. Yeah,
you said GUI.
Did I?
Yeah.
Well, the floor is made of molasses.
Well, that isn't that the same spot that they have now opened the new TWA hotel?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Because
which
again,
I go to.
It was like perfectly preserved. I don't know how they did it, but I think somebody was like, this thing, we can't do anything with this. It's just too amazing.
We can't not mention the Space Needle in Seattle.
Yeah.
Probably their most favorite. I don't know what Seattle people think of it. I don't know if they're tired of it or what. But it is their, you know, kind of one of their iconic buildings. Just ask Fraser Crane. It's right there in the skyline and those opening credits.
Mm-hmm.
But it was built in 1961 for their World Fair. And a Seattle hotel executive named Edward E. Carlson gave it its iconic name. And its chief engineer was a gentleman named John Manassian, who actually worked for NASA and designed rocket gantries.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cool. So,
yeah, it definitely legitimizes the Space Needle for sure.
So what happened to Googie?
Well, like we said, it dated itself. And Googie came along technically in 1949, but really it started to take off in the mid-50s, say. And it was based on, like you're saying, techno-optimism of the post-World War II economic boom. And us getting to space and just trying new technology. And we actually did all that stuff. Like those promises of the future actually came true pretty quick. Like we ended up on the moon in 1969. And once we got there, humanity was like, we've been there. We've done that. And like
funny?
That whole, that techno optimism, like kind of faded pretty quickly because it became everyday and commonplace. And since Googie was the architecture associated with that future that now had become everyday and commonplace, it got dated.
I think that's kind of sad, but also hysterical.
Yeah.
That like when people walked on the moon, like that next week, the dry cleaner sat down with a designer to build their new dry cleaner. It was like, they were like, well, what do you want to do? Just build me a dry cleaning.
Yeah. He was like, I'm ruined.
We've been to the moon. Who cares? I just want to clean clothes.
I saw one of the things that really signaled the death knell, maybe not earliest, but pretty early on, was that McDonald's radically changed its design from parabolas and upswept, you know, angular roofs to houses, like a brick house with a mansard roof, that really iconic 70s and 80s McDonald's look.
They look like Pizza Huts. That whole restaurant style was all the same.
Yeah, yeah. It was very close. Although I looked it up, Pizza Hut's roof is a different kind. It's not a mansard roof. I can't remember what it's called. but it, yes, it is very similar. And it was meant to evoke home, which is totally different from like a coffee shop that starts taking off up toward the sky. Like this, it was a different feel and a different vibe. And it also tied into the ecology movement, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, one might argue that some of this Googie stuff can be wasteful in terms of materials. To build a roof that extends, you know, 60 feet to a point into the sky when you just need a regular roof, really. So I think tastes sort of were tamed down a little bit, using more sort of sensible materials, I think, played a part. Going to outer space played a part, all this stuff. And like, you know, sort of any thing that doesn't end up being a classic design, it's going to come and go, especially one that's kind of radical like this. So it, you know, it was bound to have its moment and then leave and then be looked back upon with fond eyes years later. And that's what's happened largely, sadly, during, you know, of course, the 80s, a lot of these buildings in LA and the Southland were demolished. But toward the end of the 80s, certainly with the publication of the 86 book from Hess, Googie, colon, 50s coffee shop architecture, that sort of helped reignite like an appreciation for these buildings and this architecture, and more were protected that had not been demolished.
Yeah, and they're still being demolished. I saw that something like a third of them are gone now already, which is really high as far as demolition goes for a specific kind of architecture. But they are getting protected more and more, which I think is good.
Totally.
I saw one other thing that led to the demise of Googie. So Googie design was meant to attract the eyes of Southern California drivers as they were passing by so that they would turn in and be like, yeah, I could go for a cup of coffee and a piece of pie, right? Or I could get my shirt dry cleaned right now. Who knows? So that's what it was designed for. But then in 1955, the Highway Act started building highways rather than surface streets. So people weren't on those surface streets anymore, and they were going way faster. And they were going faster than Googie architecture could catch their attention. And that was a big part of it, too.
Yeah, I mean, that's as evidence in our Route 66 podcast. And to bring it full circle, that abandoned Googie gas station on Route 66 that we shot at. No one was stopping there for gas. It was closed.
Yeah, that's true. That's what happens. The highway killed it.
Highway killed it.
You got anything else?
No, I got nothing.
If you want to know more about Googie architecture, just go spend some time looking up Googie buildings. It's a lot of fun. They're just so colorful. And since I said they're colorful, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this what will it be the first of two Appalachian Trail emails. And by the way, I'm doing the Georgia portion next spring.
Oh, nice, man.
I'm doing it. Me and my friend Eddie and my friend Clay have all dedicated to do it. And so this is not only a personal life goal that I never accomplished, but a personal fitness goal, because I can't go out there right now and do that in the shape I'm in. And so losing weight, it's never worked like, oh, I got that wedding this fall I need to look good for.
Right,
like,
yeah.
That stuff never worked for me, but I can't do this like and be successful without getting in shape. Like, I will die on the side of a mountain.
Right. So. You really need to read into the woods. Because one of the characters is exactly in that same position.
All right. So it's a health goal and just a life goal. And we're going to do it next March.
So wait a minute. Wait a minute. You're going with Eddie as in Eddie the Forest Strangler? Eddie? I don't know if that's such a good idea, Chuck.
We're going to start in North Carolina at the border and go Sobo to Springer and act like we hiked the whole thing.
That's awesome.
When we get at the end.
Nice work.
So it's pretty cool. Anyway, I've been getting a lot of great emails and true stuff you should know fashion. Unplanned, but very serendipitously, that episode was released on Naked Hike Day.
Yeah.
We didn't know that was going to happen.
Nope.
But sometimes it works out that way.
Yep.
So this is from, this is a really cool one from a man named Arthur Sparrow. I wish he had put in a pronunciation guide. Uresic is what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Or Uretchik. Hey guys, long time listener, and I'm elated about this AT episode because it changed my life. It was the best crazy thing I ever decided to do when I through hiked it. I spent about a decade battling opioid addiction previous to my through hike in 2016, and when I left, I knew I needed to change many aspects of my life. I'm a college grad from a good family, had a good job, but I was just self-destructing, and the AT changed all that. The community and the trail were everything I needed. It helped me save my life from a downward spiral when it supplied hope for me when I needed it most. Simultaneously, it showed me how much we are truly capable of when we support one another on our journey. 6 months and 3 years later, still opioid free, I started my own business after doing my hike, doing work that I believe in, and now I'm living and loving my journey on and off the trail. Nice. I hope there are a few people like myself that heard your episode and like me, decide to do something crazy and change your lives for the better. It will be the best crazy thing that you ever did, too. I can assure them of that. All the best, gentlemen. Keep up the great work. And I got permission from Arthur to read this. He's the owner and operator of Green Team Junk. And way to go, Arthur. That's amazing. I'm so glad that you got it together, and I'm glad the AT was a part of that experience. It's really great.
Yeah, congratulations, Arthur. That's amazing. And thank you for the email. I wonder if Green Team is a reference to that Will Ferrell and Michael Riley and Adam McKay, like, short.
What was that?
It was called Green Team.
I don't... Why does that ring a bell?
because you've seen it. It was it made the rounds. It was viral like many years ago. Just look up Green Team. It's crazy.
And I think I said he was in the Sacramento area.
Okay.
And it looks like it's recycling and reusing and hauling away stuff for people.
Nice. Well, yeah, that's like, what I gathered.
Like green junk removal.
Right. That's what I figured. I mean, yeah, the guy hiked the AT for Pete's sake.
Yeah, it's not brown team junk.
Right. Well, thanks again, Arthur. Fantastic. Congratulations and thanks for writing in. And if you want to be like Arthur and share your personal successes with us, we want to hear them. You can send us an email to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.